and his decision, how much supporters that I had in the courtroom, even call out one of my biggest supporters, Jane Tuhol. She was in the courtroom, and the judge explained that the letter that she wrote to him moved the judge about me. Family for Freedom were there, the director, Jenny Cotton, my ex-wife, were there, my kids. I had people from all the churches that were there. Juan Carlos was there. And the support from the community was largely important. We had two rooms full with people. And I think the judge recognized that how important it was for me to have all these people who love me, who has been supporting me for the past 20 years. I mean, it was a huge victory. I'd like to thank my legal team from NYU, Miss Alina Diaz and her staff. I mean, they did an excellent job, and I'm so grateful.
Jean, let me ask Alina Diaz. I think we last had you on when you were pregnant, Alina. You were about to give birth, but you were right there standing with Jean. So in 2021, Jean is allowed back into the United States. He had sued for being banished, basically deported, for his immigrant rights activism under Trump. There's a couple of threads of legal cases here involving Jean. Can you lay out these cases? It's also just amazing that it's your students who argued the case yesterday.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Amy. And certainly, I know I speak for the entire NYU immigrant rights team, including Yolanda Loy and Gabriella McPherson, who represented Jean at the hearing yesterday. We are just so honored to be standing in solidarity with him and his incredible family in Judson Memorial Church. But you're right. There has been so much that has been poured into Jean's case. We've been inspired by his incredible voice, his leadership through Families for Freedom and the New Sanctuary movement. In New York City. It has really helped thousands of immigrants. So it was really an honor for us to step in where we could. When Jean was deported in 2018, it was part of a widespread pattern of retaliation by Immigration and Customs Enforcement against immigrant rights activists. They were targeted, they were silenced through their detention, and some, like Jean, were deported. We knew this was wrong, and so we joined Jean and his church and family and community to file a lawsuit to sue the government, to say that it's simply not right. It's against his First Amendment rights and due process rights under the Constitution to silence him for his activism through a retaliatory deportation. And we litigated that for many, many months, and thankfully, after President Biden came into office, ICE was willing to settle the case, returning Jean to the United States. I'm trying to right this one of many, many wrongs that we've seen across different administrations. So it was thrilling for us to be able to see that after this 30-year fight that Jean has led, that he's been just searching for this one fair day in court, that we were finally able to be there. But we know, because Jean has taught us this, that there are many more people who've also faced retaliation, who face retaliation to this day, and that we hope that this is the first of many such victories.
And could you talk about, Alina, the role of the drug war in several administrations now, using the criminal legal system as a tool to deport people from the United States, especially Black immigrants and people from the Caribbean?
Absolutely. Anti-Blackness is a core part of the foundations of immigration law. There is a very specific reason that immigration law uses the criminal legal system to funnel people into deportation. It basically doubles the unfairness of both systems. And so the war on drugs in the 1980s in particular was where we saw people who were facing the harshest penalties, like Jean, for involvement in drug offenses, also then facing the harshest penalties of mandatory detention, mandatory deportation, without even being able to explain your case. You know, Jean really tried to present all of his factors, all of the reasons why he should be able to stay in this country with his family, but it took 30 years for him to get that hearing and a tremendous amount of community mobilization. It was the community that really made sure that this happened. And that is part of the legacy of the war on drugs. I think Gene's son, who testified at the hearing yesterday, Josiah Montreville, said it best when he said that this is a double punishment. It is inherently unfair for Mr. Montreville to have suffered this much, for his family to suffer this much because of the war on drugs after he had already been harshly punished under that system.
And can you talk about the role, Lena, of the Virginia Governor Ralph Northam in pardoning Gene, the significance of that?
Yes, well, Gene and I talked about this yesterday at the hearing. Gene was in Haiti when Governor Northam gave him the pardon. And it was an incredible moment for Gene. I think it is a recognition of the importance of second chances, the importance of redemption. It's a value that our justice system has often forgotten. And that was a rare moment of victory. It was something that Gene, Janae Cawthon, and the entire team at Judson Memorial Church fought for many, many years. And it's important to recognize that people at all levels of government have a responsibility to exercise their power to make sure that we can find justice for people like Gene, who've been through so many years of injustice. There is so much that people can do if they're willing to exercise that power for good.
And Gene, now that you've finally gotten this 30-year saga behind you, what are your expectations or hopes for what you expect to do in the future?
Well, I'm 54 years old, about to start a new life, and my family, my sons. I mean, just be able to be with my kids. My son Josiah, he actually right now in college. My daughter has graduated. I still have a 16-year-old sophomore in high school. I want to see my kids progress, and I want to be there alongside of them, you know, take them to school, make sure they stay out of trouble, and be responsible human and pay responsible human beings, you know. It's so hard. This case has always been about the separations of families. I didn't like it, the fact that years ago the government used to just break doors down and separate families. I think now my kids and myself, we do have a bright future ahead of us. I'm planning to, you know, work with them, stay with them, continue to support them.
Do you see citizenship on the horizon, Gene?
I'm sorry, Amy.
Do you see citizenship on the horizon?
Well, I think so, you know, and last night I got home, I was thinking about it because there's this question that's been in my mind for so many years. Gene, why are you fighting to stay in this country knowing the racial BS and all they have done to me? And now you want to become a citizen? Last night I thought about it. But, you know, I do like the Biden administration. As you know, Haiti right now is in turmoil. Haiti has gotten 10 times worse since I left Haiti just over a year ago. The whole country is running by gangs, remember? And just in January 6th, Joe Biden finally recognized that and give the Haitian an opportunity to come over here without having a visa. If you have someone here that can apply for it to support you financially, they get approved to come over here and apply for political asylum. I think, me, myself, to answer your question, I would really like to settle myself in this country. I've been here for almost 40 years. This is the only country that I know. I don't want to think about going back to Haiti. So I probably will have my citizenship one day, but as you know, I have to apply for it. Hopefully, I receive it.
Well, Gene Montreville, longtime Haitian immigrant activist, welcome home. And Alina Das, part of the legal team for Gene and co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law, thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, we'll look at the growing controversy around Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Stay with us.
And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man. son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know we'll have a good time then. I've long since retired, my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. Said I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids have the flu, but it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me.
Harry Chapin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at the growing calls for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to step down or be impeached, a second damning ProPublica report on his relationship with Republican megadonor Harlan Crow has revealed that in 2014, Thomas and his family sold a house and two vacant lots in Savannah, Georgia, to Crow for around $130,000, but never disclosed the sale, which appears to be a violation of the 1978 Ethics in Government Act. CNN reports Thomas's mother lives in the home owned by Crow rent-free, but she's reportedly responsible for paying the property taxes and insurance. On Sunday, The Washington Post reported Thomas has for years claimed rental income from a Nebraska real estate firm that shut down in 2006. It's also been reported previously that in 2009, Crow gave $500,000 to a conservative lobbying group founded by Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas. CNN reports Justice Clarence Thomas now intends to amend his financial disclosures in light of ProPublica's other recent bombshell investigation detailing unreported luxury trips Harlan Crow lavished on Thomas over two decades in apparent violation of a law requiring justices and other federal officials to disclose most gifts. Thomas frequently vacationed at Crow's resort in the Adirondacks of New York, where a painting on the walls depicts Clarence Thomas sitting with four other men, including Harlan Crow and Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. Thomas never reported any of the free trips as gifts. In addition to being a major benefactor for Thomas and the GOP, Crow is also an avid collector of Nazi memorabilia. He's got a signed copy of Mein Kampf. That's right, signed by Hitler. Paintings by Hitler, Nazi medallions, swastika embossed linens, and a garden filled with statues of 20th century dictators. For more, we're joined by Justin Elliott once again, reporter for ProPublica. Their new follow-up report headlined, Billionaire Harlan Crow bought property from Clarence Thomas. The justice didn't disclose the deal. Justin, welcome back to Democracy Now! I mean, your initial report has unleashed an avalanche of reporting and investigations and calls for Clarence Thomas to be impeached or to step down. He says he's going to amend his disclosure forms. Can you talk about the latest findings?
Yeah, you know, for our first story, both Thomas and Harlan Crow put out statements about the luxury travel, saying we're very close friends. These were family trips. They both used the word hospitality. We subsequently learned and reported that there was actually a direct business deal, a real estate deal between the two men, so actual money flowing from Harlan Crow to Clarence Thomas. What we found is that around a decade ago, Crow bought a house and two vacant lots that were owned by Clarence Thomas and some of his relatives down in Savannah, Georgia. You know, as you mentioned, the house that Crow bought is actually the house where Thomas's elderly mother was living and apparently still lives, which puts Crow in the extremely unusual position of being the landlord to the mother of a sitting Supreme Court justice, although it's actually not clear if landlord's the right term here because CNN has reported that Crow is not charging her rent. So there's all kinds of exceedingly unusual financial entanglements between this billionaire political donor and the Supreme Court justice.
And Justin, what about this claim that they've been longtime friends? What were you able to find out about how Thomas and Harlan Crowe first met and how their friendship developed?
Yeah, you know, so I think they actually are friends, but it turns out that, at least according to Crowe, they met back in the mid-1990s. So this was after Thomas was on the court. They weren't like college roommates or something like that. They actually apparently met at a conservative political conference, and Crowe gave an interview to the Dallas Morning News a couple days ago in which he says that they actually first met when Crowe offered Thomas, it turns out, a private jet ride on Crowe's jet from Washington, D.C. to Dallas, and apparently they hit it off on the jet. So that's what we know about how it started.
So from the start, then, Thomas was accepting, in essence, of undisclosed gifts from Crowe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have personally never been on a private jet, but I've learned a lot about them. And, you know, these things, I mean, Crowe's current jet, it's a particularly nice private jet. It's a Global 5000 Bombardier. If you were to charter one of these on the open market, you'd be paying $15,000 per hour. Per flight hour. So, yes, these are extraordinarily expensive flights, and it's obviously not exactly a normal situation to offer somebody you just met a private jet ride. But again, I mean, Clarence Thomas was a Supreme Court justice at the time, so I think that probably goes a long way to explaining why this happened.
And can you talk about Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, the connection here and the financial connections with Harlan Crowe? I mean, the getting more than $500,000, her lobbying group.
That's right. So I think one of the other really intriguing financial connections here between Crowe and the Thomas family is related to Ginny Thomas. So it actually came out around a dozen years ago that Ginny Thomas was running a small Tea Party group, nonprofit political organization. And it came out that that none other than Harlan Crowe was pretty much the sole funder of that group that was paying Ginny Thomas's salary, which I believe was on the order of $200,000 a year. So essentially through this kind of pass-through organization, Crowe's money was ending up, you know, in the pocket of the Thomas household. Following that reporting around a dozen years ago, there was sort of a previous round of questions about this, but and we don't really know what has happened since then. Partly, actually, thanks to the Supreme Court, as you know, the whole regime of disclosure of political spending and giving to groups has really fallen apart, and there's anonymous dark money flowing all over the place. So it makes it very difficult as a reporter to figure out where money is flowing and from who. But, you know, we're still reporting on all this.
And Justice Thomas has claimed that Crowe has no business before the Supreme Court. But for those who do not know of our audience who do not know Crowe, who is he and what would be his interest in being able to have this friendship with Thomas?
So Crowe is a real estate billionaire who was born into a very successful Dallas real estate family. And it is true that Crowe he's not been a litigant in a case at the Supreme Court. It turns out the Supreme Court doesn't actually take that many cases every year. So there's very few people and companies that are actually have a case at the court. But the court regularly takes up matters that affect the real estate industry, that the real estate trade groups that Harlan Crowe helps fund is involved in some of those cases, filing briefs and that kind of thing. But I think the larger issue is that Crowe has a whole set of ideological interests related to the court. He's a funder of a number of groups that specifically push conservative legal theories, groups like the Federalist Society. He's on the board of a number of think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute that work on a range of issues, but among them, issues related to the Supreme Court, advancing conservative legal theories. So it raises the question, and we don't really know the answer at this point, of whether Crow and sort of his other friends who he's bringing on some of these trips with Justice Thomas are, you know, having any influence on the justice. And, you know, even shifting a Supreme Court justice's thinking a little bit on an issue, if that ended up in an opinion, I mean, it could have just enormous consequences for basically all of us.
Well, Justin Elliott, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter for ProPublica. We will link to your reports. This is Democracy Now! For more on the calls for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to step down or be impeached in light of the recent revelations, we're going to look at a historical reference when, 54 years ago, a Supreme Court justice was forced to quit for behavior arguably less egregious than Thomas's. That's the headline of an op-ed in the New York Times by Adam Cohen, lawyer, journalist, former member of the New York Times editorial board, author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Adam, you write that Justice Abe Fortas's departure from the court in 1969 is both a blueprint for how lawmakers could respond today and a benchmark of how far we have fallen. Can you lay out this history?
Sure. It is really the most on-point parallel we have historically. And one thing that's important to note is that what Abe Fortas did is in many ways much less bad than what Clarence Thomas did. The amount of money was much smaller. He took $20,000. And as you mentioned, and as Justin mentioned, you know, Clarence Thomas, the amount of island hopping and, you know, free plane rides over a 20-year period is staggering, probably well into the millions. So the dollar amount was different, but also, Fortas gave the money back, which is something that Clarence Thomas has not done. So we have a much smaller scandal in many ways. And what was striking is the bipartisan response that there was in 1969. Fortas ended up resigning from the court, not because Republicans were out to get him, and he was a liberal Democrat, but because Walter Mondale, who was in the Senate, demanded that he resign. His one of his biggest supporters in the Senate, Senator Tidings from Maryland, demanded that he resign. He was afraid that he would be impeached by a Democratic Congress. And what's really striking also is that this is at a time when there was a Republican president, Nixon. So Democrats were doing this even though they knew that they might, quote, lose the seat, a liberal being replaced by a conservative. But these Democrats were so concerned about the integrity of the court, and they kept saying what matters is that the public have faith in the court. We're not seeing that at all today. Where are the Republicans who are coming out in favor of Thomas stepping down or Thomas doing anything really because of the integrity of the court? We don't have that kind of bipartisanship anymore.
And could you also talk, Adam, about how the media have responded to this case? Fox News has filled the void by locating, quote, an expert to declare that the story about Justice Thomas is politics, plain and simple.
That's exactly right. Yes, the media has the conservative media have defended Clarence Thomas. And as you said, they found an expert who doesn't seem like much of an expert to say that it's not a big deal. But also, you know, just where are the voices of, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, for example? Right. I mean, we saw last year when there were leaks of that abortion ruling a year ago, the Chief Justice immediately launched an investigation. We have to get to the bottom of this. What's going on in the court? Why is he not saying that now? Why is it a much bigger deal that there were leaks of an abortion ruling, which conservatives were upset about, compared to Clarence Thomas apparently ignoring ethics rules for years? Where is the Chief Justice in this? We're not hearing from him at all.
And why has the Supreme Court been able to get by so for so long with essentially no ethics requirements?
That's exactly it. It's the least accountable part of government we have. There is a judicial code of ethics that's quite, I wouldn't say strong, but it's a reasonable code. But it doesn't apply to the Supreme Court. It applies to lower court judges. Why does it not apply to the Supreme Court? Why do we not have, you know, as I said, investigations internally? Even the liberal justices could be talking out now. If they think that Clarence Thomas is breaking the law, I think they have a duty to say something. So there's really no one holding them accountable. the body that would be doing it is, you know, the one real check on the Supreme Court is impeachment. But right now, the House is in the control of Republicans, so they're not doing anything. There have been calls from the Senate, which does have a Democratic majority, for an investigation. Maybe that will happen. But this is a broken system, and many people are using this Clarence Thomas scandal to say, you know, we've gone on too long without an actual ethics code that applies to the justices, and Congress should pass one now.
Adam, you wrote a book on the Supreme Court called Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Can you relate the ethics scandal that Clarence Thomas is facing today to the theme of your book?
Yeah, it's a great point, Amy. What I argue in the book is that we think of the Supreme Court as being a force for equality and fairness and all that. But if you actually look back to the last 50 years after Nixon packed the court with conservatives, it's actually been a force for protecting rich people, for increasing inequality. So in areas like campaign finance, where they have struck down all these often good laws that Congress passed trying to regulate the amount of money from rich people going into politics, in education, where they've ruled in favor of inequality in funding, and on and on and on. So that has been the theme. We've had a court that for 50 years has been really fighting for rich people over poor people. That's only gotten worse in the last few years because now we have this 6-3 conservative majority. So it's worse than it's ever been. This is very strongly related because think about when you have corruption, when you have financial corruption, when you have justices taking, you know, free trips for 20 years, you know, the ProPublica referred to it as, you know, island hopping. Who is giving that? That's being given by billionaires, people like Crow, right? Welfare recipients who might have business before the court, they can't afford to give the justices, you know, these luxury vacations. Student loan debt holders right now, who there's a big case before the Supreme Court, if you're in heavy student loan debt, you're not able to, you don't have a yacht to take Clarence Thomas on. So this is yet another way in which the balance is tipped in favor of the powerful and the wealthy. And, you know, when we talk about this friendship, as Justin was saying, it's a friendship between Crow and Thomas that was made after Thomas became a justice. So you have to wonder about that. But you also have to wonder if Clarence Thomas started out ruling in favor of poor people, welfare recipients, took liberal positions, would he continue to get these luxury vacations? I would say not. One of the reasons he's getting them is because I would argue, it seems to me, that Crow likes what he's doing on the court. So this is a way to put one more big thumb on the scale in favor of wealthy people before the court. So it's very ideologically corrupting.
And Adam, Harlan Crow, for all of his power within the Republican Party, we learn he has this Nazi collection, swastika embossed linens, a signed copy of Mein Kampf. So a Hitler embracing, you know, mega millionaire, if not billionaire. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he has said he's just interested in these historical artifacts, and he's not in any way a Nazi. That's his position. Look, I want to accept that on one level, but on the other hand, I just know that it would creep me out so much to have Hitler's signature, you know, in my home. And beyond that, I just wouldn't go out and buy it. I mean, these are, you know, these are really artifacts of something so horrible that what is the draw? I mean, I don't know. We'll have to take him at his word, but it gives me the willies, honestly.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Adam Cohen, lawyer, journalist, former member of the New York Times editorial board, will link to your New York Times guest essay. 54 years ago, a Supreme Court justice was forced to quit for behavior arguably less egregious than Thomas's. Adam Cohen is also author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Yastu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanjeev Lopez. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.